Warning. This episode contains discussions of sensitive topics, including suicide, depicted in the film Ganja and Hess. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello, everyone. My name is Jason Ramirez, and welcome to another episode of the Hit List Podcast, a podcast where me and a guest cross off films from our watch list and discuss them. Today, I'm joined by fellow filmmaker and HSF alum, Nakai Morales. Welcome, Nakai. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Jason. I'm really excited to be on and excited to talk about Ganja and Hess.
Well, before we get on with that, I just want to do a little couple icebreakers. My first icebreaker, I'm doing like traditional icebreaker questions now.
No, I got it.
If you could travel anywhere in the world, where would you go?
If I could travel anywhere in the world, I would probably go to... This is hard. Toss up between like Japan and Belgium. Personally, I really want to go to Japan. I've been wanting. I'm like a huge anime fan, so was very obsessed with it in middle school. So it's definitely on my. Yeah, it's like it's on my bucket list. But Belgium, specifically because they have a really good like rave scene, and I have gotten like into like raving and going to like clubs and stuff in the past year. So I think it would be like a really great time. If you wanted one answer.
No, I've always wanted to go to Japan. It's just like what's been stopping me for so long is like the price. You know, like I'm on the east coast of the United States, getting there from where I am, it costs money.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the price. It's just a flight from then. It's just a flight. And then, yeah.
It's like $1,500. I was looking at going to Iceland, not Iceland, Greenland. I'm going to mix up. I was thinking of going to Greenland because it is like the same price to go from Philadelphia to Greenland as it is to go from Philadelphia to Colorado.
Wow.
And I think it's just because it's like a similar distance, but I was like, oh, that is insane.
It's crazy because you mentioned Iceland. I'm now considering going to Iceland only because of Leve.
Yeah.
The chances of me meeting here are kind of low, but if we do meet, like maybe we'll fall in love.
It's fate. You gotta see where your like love line and like your zodiacs and like
the invisible string theory, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Have you traveled anywhere before, like outside the country?
Yeah. So, actually, this is really funny because we know each other from the HSF Media Entertainment Summit. We met in 2019.
Yeah.
That same week. So, like, literally, when I got back home, I went on another flight to Denmark.
Oh, that's so cool.
So I spent a week in Denmark by myself, and specifically Copenhagen, and
yeah.
I had so much fun. Like, it's like it was the first time I ever traveled to another country by myself,
mm-hmm.
especially in another continent, and I had to basically come up with my own fun because like it was just me. Like, it was up to me to like have my own fun, and I got to meet a lot of great people and took a lot of pictures. And let me see if I can, like, hold on, I have a picture here.
Okay.
There's a Christmas market, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were promoting Klaus, like Netflix promoting the movie Klaus.
Yeah.
And so they had like, you kind of like.
That is so much fun.
Yeah. It's before the mustache.
Yeah. You look good. I was actually supposed to go to Copenhagen that following year.
Oh, man.
For study abroad, but I couldn't afford it, unfortunately. But it didn't really matter because everyone came back. Everyone came back a couple months later. So... I've gone to, I studied abroad in Italy for a couple months. And then while I was there, I went to, Paris and Amsterdam and Dublin and just those places. And also I think Tuscany. We went one day up to Tuscany and that was an amazing time. And I've just been wanting to travel ever since, especially since we've been inside so much. So trying to get out there more. It's not getting like, I don't know what I'm saying. I'm just excited to be outside more in the future.
Yeah, in the words of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, we outside?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man. All right. So, yeah, there's a lot more I could talk about traveling. But it feels like that would be like another podcast to itself.
Yeah.
But today we're talking about vampires. Ganja and Hess is a 1973 American horror film written and directed by Bill Gunn and starring Marlene Clark and Dwayne Jones. The film follows the exploits of anthropologist Dr. Hess Green, who becomes a vampire after his intelligent but unstable assistant stabs him with an ancient cursed dagger. Green falls in love with his assistant's widow, Ganja, who learns Green's dark secret. This film was on Nakai's list. Nakai, why was this movie on your list?
Yeah, so more recently, I fell in love with the film Dry Longzo by Colleen Smith. Do you know that one?
No, I haven't heard that.
Well, it's a 90s movie that was made by Colleen Smith while she was in film school. And the reason I fell in love with it is because the entire movie was on YouTube. And then I watched it on YouTube, I fell in love with it, and literally got a month later an email from the Criterion Collection that they were doing a 4K re-release of it.
Wow.
And because of that, I was like, I want to see more movies like this. I want to see more movies made by Black people in the early 80s, 90s, 70s. Just want to see more Black film and more Black independent film as that. And Ganja and Hess was one of the first things that came up because it recently had its 50th anniversary. Mm. So I was also watching a lot of vampire films. I watched Thirst. Do you know that one?
It sounds familiar.
It's who is in that movie? I'm like, oh, the guy from the dad from Parasite. He is the lead in the movie. Park Chan Wook.
Yeah. Song Kang Ho.
Yes.
So, yeah. He's a G.
Yeah, he's really good. He was in that. So I've just been kind of into vampire stuff recently, and I feel like the only kind of vampire stuff that I really know is Twilight, maybe Dracula a little bit. So I was really excited to see a different take on vampires, especially from a Black perspective, from a Korean perspective, and Ganja and Hess was definitely on there. And to see that this movie is was kind of missed in its first debut, but still premiered at Cannes in the 70s, I'm like, that's kind of a big deal. It would at least be considered a big deal today. So that is really why it was on my list. And since watching it, I've also fallen down a Marlene Clark rabbit hole because I really like her as an actress. I thought she was really good in the movie. And she's in a lot of stuff, a lot more than I had realized. So that's kind of how I fell into Ganja and Hess.
Gotcha. So he kind of felt into a rabbit hole like most of us do.
Yeah.
And it just happened to come up. That's how I find most of my movies too. There was a little bit ago, I fell into a huge Western rabbit hole, and I found out about The Good, the Bad, the Weird, which isn't an American or Italian movie. It's a Korean movie that's also a Western set in Manchuria. And to me, it's still one of the best Western movies out there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't even made by people from the West.
And I think that's really where I get inspired when I see people that take a genre that is not usually made for them and are not made for them, not advertised towards them. And then they take it a step further and they put their own spin on it. And although I was saying at the beginning, Ganja and Hess is honestly not a movie that I would probably watch in normal circumstances. It's been on my list for a hot minute. I still really enjoyed it because I was dang, this is I don't know. It's speaking to a part of me that I feel I didn't know was there in the first place. So yeah.
Ganja and Hess, what were your first impressions?
Slow. It is a slow movie. damn, that is one thing that I think is really the hardest part for me is that it's a slow burn, but one thing that I really love is how pointed the direction of the movie is and how aesthetically pleasing it is for me. Because it feels like a dream. It feels like a fever.
Yeah.
Like a fever dream throughout the entire thing, but there is still a cohesive narrative, even though it's not being told necessarily linearly. And that's something that I really admire about the movie. I think also to have such a an aesthetic, an artistic direction for a movie that didn't really have a big box office or a big budget on its own, I think that just goes to show the power of indie films and how it doesn't really matter how much money you have or how much equipment you have. You can make a good movie that speaks to a lot of people, and sometimes it doesn't get the recognition it deserves, but it doesn't mean that it's not a good movie nonetheless. Those were my initial thoughts on it. I'm I could ramble a little bit about this.
Yeah, for me, I also, it's not the type of movie I would go out of my way to watch, But I'm glad I watched it, because sometimes it can be kind of stuck in the echo chamber and you don't even realize it, especially with Hollywood genre films. I went into this expecting a Hollywood genre film, just like what the producers commissioned Bill Gunn to do. But I got something completely different I never would have expected by myself.
Yeah.
And just like you said, The way it is slow, but I like it because the camera lingers mm-hmm. on shots. You know, like there's like the scene where Hess is at the church, being prayed for by the minister.
Yeah.
And then there's also that shot where Gudge and Hess are having dinner together, and then she just goes off into the background and just like throwing papers around mm-hmm. and just lingers there. And then
yeah
there's a lot of good shots where it does that. It just lingers, and you just have to sit with it, you know. Yeah. And I feel like we don't get that enough.
You're absolutely right. And I think also for a movie like that is like way ahead of its time, like I feel like a lot of us see memes about like yearning and like, you know, wanting something more. And I feel like Ganja and Hess really like hits it on the head, where it's not only like you are yearning for like love and to be like seen, but you're also like yearning for, in the sense of the movie, like they are yearning for like blood, they're yearning for each other. And I feel like it, like with all the overlays of like biblical imagery and whatnot, mm-hmm. I don't know, it just really spoke to me in that essence. And I was like, dang, I feel like I am yearning in this movie with these people. And it's not even like, I wouldn't even say it's like really like a romance movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that either.
Like it, like there is like romantic aspects, but also if you think about like romance, like its origins are usually like based around tragedy and like death and like the heartbreak. So I don't know. It's a really interesting movie on that spectrum.
Yeah, you just mentioned like the way the yearning. I didn't even think about that. Like when they literally first meet and they lock eyes, and then she just walks away. It's like, tell your boss I'm here to be seeing him. He's like, I am Dr. Green, and I thought that was. That was kind of funny.
Yeah, Marlene Clark, amazing in this role. Let me tell you, can I cuss? Is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Dang, I love like when someone is just like a bitch, like just being like, just straight up like, I don't fuck with you, or like I don't, you are so like not on my radar that I don't. Like, I don't even think that you're the person that I'm talking to originally. We recently watched Saltburn, and I love the mom. The mom is, like, my favorite character in the movie. And it's just because she's, like, a little bit mean. And I think Marlene Clark does, like, an amazing job, like, portraying that character. Like, I'm like, yes, this woman gets everything she wants and will do whatever she needs to do for herself. And she like sets that up like so instantly, like calling this guy, calling him back. Like he hangs up on her, and then she calls back and is like, no, I'm coming to stay there because I know you have room. So, and I'm like, that's a power move. That's a power move that I appreciate. And even when like I've like been doing like some reading after the movie, like that, like Ganja's character is she is like more of like the lead in the movie.
Yeah.
Even though it like follows like Hess throughout the entire movie, like all the decisions that she decides to do are very like in self-preservation, and that's also like why like she's like first in the movie. Like it's Ganja mm-hmm. and Hess and not Hess and Ganja. And I just think that's like really interesting, and also for a movie in the 70s where it's like one, like a black woman is being portrayed as self-preserving and also like smart enough to know what she needs to do without necessarily like there were a lot of like blaxploitation films that were like around at that time that really just kind of like paint black women in this like superpower light, and she's like, she's just like a normal woman, but that doesn't mean that she like should be washed over. I think that's a really good and like interesting like take on that. I also feel like with like vampire and like love stories, it's like the woman is usually like at the beck and call of the person who turned her, but that doesn't really feel like it in this case. She's very much like abrasive the entire movie, where she's like, I want to do certain things. Even when they like leave the lover in the field, like she's like, he's still alive, like I don't want to leave him here. And like eventually she gives up, but I don't think she ever like really thought about it, or like didn't she like, how do I explain it? She gave up in that instance, but also was like, you know, it's going to work out. I don't know.
She was like, c'est la vie.
Yeah, like that is life. Like it is what it is. Like I have to keep moving.
I see. Yeah. That's something I noticed as well. Like when she had like that monologue and she was in the dark. And the thing that she said that like stuck out to me was like, Ganja takes care of Ganja.
Yeah.
And we see that throughout the movie, like for like the reason she married Hess was for his money. She even said like the reason why she's there is for money.
Yeah.
And then like I'm not sure why she chose to become a vampire. I know that Hess didn't want to be alone in his vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
But like the fact that she didn't like die by choice was for her own choice as well, you know.
Yeah.
Like she took the lead on that.
Yeah. And I think that that's also something that really like attracts me to like vampire movies and movies about like the occult kind of in general, is that especially in this movie, I really don't know what the characters are thinking like half the time. Like I'm kind of like, what, like it's a little bit like, oh, what's going on, but also you like know what's happening in the movie, and it makes that like that yearning aspect I feel like a little stronger, because I'm like, I don't know actually what they want out of the situation. Like Ganja could have wanted, you know, one, his money, but two, if she becomes a vampire, then he can't kill her unless she unless he like actually like goes and tries to kill her. So they're now both immortal, and she'll get that money either way. She'll like still win in this situation. And then in the end, like he decides like, this is too much for me, I can't do it anymore. And she's like, okay. Is like, okay, and she continues living. She continues living, and you see the guy that they leave in the field come running out. And I'm like, wow, that is, like, she still gets what she wants in the end.
Yeah.
That is, and that's really, I think that's a novel ending in the fact that, like, one, yeah, a vampire still dies, but, like, it's not really, like, over.
Mm-hmm. So, I do want to talk about that ending a little bit.
Yeah.
Because he comes up from the pool running towards her. Like, we assume running towards her, and jumps over Archie's body, that we can only assume that she killed him. Because you know, she was very condescending towards him. Which, by the way, she did a very good job of me not liking her. Because I'm very much for the people.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up working class. I still am, technically. And so I'm very much for the people. And so whenever people are, like, taking advantage or, like, condescending towards them, even in fiction, I'm like, I don't like you.
Yeah.
So, like, I can acknowledge, like, I know it's a fictional movie, but I was like, I don't like you. You're doing a good job, but I don't like you.
Yeah. And, like, Archie was just trying to do his job the entire time. I think one of the lines that stuck out is, like, I came with the house to me. And, like, that also, like, feels like it came, like, with, or not, it reminded me of, in Saltburn, they have, like, the butler in it. And he, Jacob Elordi's character is like, yeah, I'm pretty sure he like is with the estate or something along those lines. It's just like to show like how old this guy is, and like he probably did care not only about like the estate, but like his boss as well, in a sense. Mm-hmm. And she's just kind of like, you are disposable, and that is, it's insane, but it's also that's something that I admire about a character as well. Like I like a good villain personally. And I think she's like a villain, but also she's like not at the same time. It's very interesting in that regard. But yeah, the guy runs out, and he jumps over Archie's body, and it's like, one, I'm like, what is he running for? Is he running because he is like, he wants to see her? Is he running because like, oh, I know you left me in this field.
Yeah.
Like, am I going to like, is like, are you going to kill Ganja? Because that's I feel like also a valid thing to do, but also at the same time, like, Ganja was also trying to fight for like, hey, he's still alive, like, and also knowing that, hey, he's still alive, he's probably gonna become a vampire, he's gonna come back at some point, right? Like, if you don't take all the blood out, or you don't kill him, like, then that's the whole point, they become vampires again. And it's almost like Hess didn't really like think about that.
Yeah.
And it seemed, I don't know if in the moment when Ganja was being pulled away, if that's also what she was thinking. Like, he's still alive.
Yeah, exactly. Know? But yeah, that's what I was thinking too. Like, I interpret it as like, he's mad at her, and he's coming to get her. Mm-hmm. And but I've seen other people say like, oh, Ganja's getting what she wants in the end because like, she thought he was the better lover or whatever. Like, he's he's easier to manipulate because he's just a social worker who volunteers and all that. But like, you know, sometimes the working class just can't put up with it anymore.
It's so true. It's true. And it's like, I also feel that with that whole situation, you know, Ganja is the one that seduced him.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, you know, now the only other person that could possibly know like what you're going through is the person that also killed you. so or like made you into what this is. And I think that also is kind of like what Bill Gunn is like trying to say, like, you know, he is trying to show this like relation between these two characters, but also there is like a very clear disconnect in how they both became vampires. Like there's love involved, but there also isn't, in a sense. Like for Ganja, it was like a power dynamic from the get-go. But with this other guy, he was probably like genuinely like, oh, this woman really likes me and I'm going to sleep with her now. And she takes advantage of that. So it's like there's still that like the link of the power dynamic, but it's also like, I don't know. It's a really weird movie. And I watched it yesterday and then I was doing like some reading today and I was like, I feel like I kind of like need to rewatch it so I can like get all of it. There was so much that was going on. But yeah.
It's a movie.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie. It's a good one. It's definitely going to be a while before I rewatch it, to be completely honest. I did just rent it also.
And the thing is, it also challenges like traditional representations of vampire like films and also mythology, because for one, he can go out in the day. Hess, when he becomes a vampire, he can go out in the day. And he also isn't bitten by a vampire, he's stabbed by a cursed dagger.
And I think that was more really what like drew me into the movie to know like, oh, it wasn't like he knew someone that made him into a vampire. He was murdered by an ancient artifact. I don't know. The idea of like an ancient artifact turning someone into something is so like fantasy, so like Dungeons and Dragons-esque that I'm like, oh, I love that concept. Like, it's just.
I thought there was more lore behind that dagger too, because I thought it was wooden, right? And then I thought like maybe back then it was used to kill a vampire, like a stake through the heart. And then that dagger was saved because, you know, that's the only way to kill a vampire. But it's also the same way you kill a human, you know, a stake through the heart will kill most people too.
It's true. A stake through the heart would kill a lot of things.
So then I guess that was saved throughout the years just in case, but like the blood was still like seep through into like the dagger,
The pores.
like the germ, the vampire germs. But no, it's a dagger carved out of a bone is what it is. And I just found it very unique. Like what
It's like, was it a
it
vampire bone? You know, like,
exactly.
and it's also like, as an anthropologist, like he is like the people he's like studying are like they drink blood, like that is like their thing, and that's also like how he gets involved. So it could have just been like one of their bones, but like even that, like that just concept in general is really interesting, and I do want to see like more vampire movies do something a little different with how people become vampires. The daywalking, I'm like, I can forget. Personally, I'm like I feel like day walking with vampires has become like such a like a thing, especially like after Twilight. You know, they were outside during the day. Most of the time it was cloudy, but like they were still out. They were outside. And this concept of like the dagger is just really, I don't know. I've been thinking about that a lot because I am gonna use it for Dungeons and Dragons whenever we start playing again.
And something else that I found very unique is that, like, in vampire movies, the cross was scares Dracula, right? Crosses will kill a vampire, whatever. It's not really explained why. And, like, I guess most vampire films, if it has been, I don't know why. But I like how in this movie, it's the shadow of the cross that can kill the vampire over their heart. And how in it's in the song in the beginning of the movie, like the lore behind the vampires in Africa and how they were killed without really dying. Killed in such a way that they could not die. I think that's one of the lyrics. And so, and the only way to like die, they had to have the cross upon them. But it was before Christ, so they had to just stay like that for a while until the Christians came. That's like one of the lyrics too. I found it very unique. Like, yeah, so like before Christ, y'all were screwed.
I think that's another thing that's really cool about it is that it's like it's building this like vampire lore of like what were vampires before Christianity was a thing, and also how Christianity plays such a big part in like being black at times, like especially it was like used to subjugate black people into slavery and just you know spread colonization and whatnot. And I think that it kind of shows like, oh, you know, things there were ways to circumvent that, like Christianity wasn't needed, but also it like plays such a huge role in the movie with like the kind of like the gothic aspects of it. I think That's another thing that I also really like about this movie is that is how it expands on the lore. Did you watch like the Castlevania anime?
Oh, hell yeah.
One of the like quotes in like the more recent seasons, I'm pretty sure, was
The
like,
spin-off
"Oh,
or like the original?
I can't remember. I just
Okay.
remember it was in the Castlevania show." And I think it was in the original because it was Trevor Belmont talking about like the cross and that the cross doesn't actually like really hurt them. It just like confuses them. Like it's like looking at a bunch of zebras, like their like eyes get messed up when they look at a cross. And I thought that like in that moment, I was like, that is actually a really cool piece of lore that explains like why does the cross do it without necessarily going down the Christianity route. And with Ganja and Hess, it's like it's taking that almost like even a step further. And you're almost being able to travel back in time to where like hey, like these are how the people did deal with vampires or people at some point.
So, were there any like notable scenes or shots that stood out to you?
I think that the scene that really stands out to me is like right before Ganja becomes a vampire with like the cellar, because up until this point in the movie, like you are seeing Hess like kind of do what he needs to do to survive and whatnot. And with that, when Ganja is in this house and like, oh, I need wine and everything, and she's pushing Archie, and he's like, I'm not even allowed to go down there without him, like you shouldn't go down there. And this is how she like is revealed. I think that like all the scenes like after that are really like beautiful, super intricate. It's not even necessarily like a single scene. It is the use of blood in the film that I think really stands out to me, and how it is like this. It is like paint. It is like red paint that they are using for blood. And I don't know. I watch a lot of stuff with gore in it in general, and it was almost like refreshing to see like this isn't like really a gory movie. Like there's blood in it, people are dying, but like there's no it's not gratuitous. Like I'm not feeling like disgusted. I get freaked out when I see things with like eyes and whatnot, like people messing with eyes, and I'm like, this is just simple. Like you get bit and then you start bleeding or you get stabbed and there's blood coming out of your mouth and now they're drinking it. And it's like it's gross, but it's not like it's palatable. And I think that's something that I really enjoyed about the movie. And I think that like red paint is like it's just so stark in like all the imagery that like anytime I'm thinking of the movie, I am thinking of how the blood is either splattered or it's like on people's clothes or it's coming out of them, and it's like it's very obviously not blood. But it like just adds to like the aesthetic factor of the movie. Like it is so pigmented, it's so rich that it like for all the other scenes involving churches or candlelight and whatnot, or when they're wearing red clothes, it is like jewels almost. I also think it's the scene after Ganja kills the lover, and his back is like covered in like
Oh,
red blood.
yeah.
That scene was like breathtaking to me because I was like, this looks like it was like bedazzled, like with how the light was shining on his back. And it is like this very bright pigment red blood. And I was like, wow, that is like a really pretty scene. Like it just really spoke to me. So I think anything involving blood in the movie was really cool to me. I was like, I'm locking that in my brain for later use because I'm tired of gore. I need something. I need a little less personally.
Yeah, that reminds me of how like I forgot which article was I was reading about Ganja and Hess, but someone said it was more disgusting to see Bill Gunn brush his teeth with his own bath water than seeing the blood. And
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? You're right, because that
It's
was,
it is it is like out of
because that's
pocket.
real.
Yeah. Or oh my gosh, not only him brushing his teeth, because I had to like rewind that scene because I was like, did I see this correctly? He spit into the water but then immediately like cupped the spit water and then like washed his face with it. And I was like, this is gross. Like it's one thing to like brush your teeth in the shower, but you literally just like spit in it and then rubbed it all over your face. That is unhygienic for a vampire movie. I don't know.
Yeah, because like I said, because it's real, you know,
Yeah.
like we know the blood is fake, you know, like you can be a little grossed out of it and then get used to it as we go on. But what we saw with the water, that was real.
Yeah, that was real. That we saw that happen. And that water was not clear.
No, it was
It was
not. It was
not clear. It
cloudy.
was very cloudy. Oh gosh, I didn't even like really think about that again until you brought it up right now. I'm like, yeah, that scene was kind of gross.
For me, like there's like a specific shot that stood out to me, and It took me a while to watch this movie. It took me a couple of days to watch this movie because it's so unlike anything I've ever seen before. Mm-hmm. And I'm not used to something like this, but it's the scene where Hess goes out to see George Mita. He's on the tree.
Yeah.
And he's contemplating suicide. And there's like a noose right there. And the shot looks like Hess has like the noose on him. Mm-hmm. Even though he's in front of the noose, I just felt like, oh, it's just like, it's obvious foreshadowing as to what's going to happen in this movie.
It is obvious foreshadowing. And with that, I do want to, like, I'm going to take a little more serious tone here. I did recently lose a friend to suicide, so that scene was actually really hard for me to watch. And I think that's also what, like, has kind of, like, skewed, like, my personal view of the movie. Because a lot of it, especially after reading, like, different articles and whatnot, they were saying that the movie's about, like, love and addiction and whatnot. And, like, you know, needing to, like, get that fix and whatnot. Movie's about love and addiction and needing to get that fix. But for me, when I was watching it, I was very much like, it is a movie about grief. It's about losing people around you and how that changes you as a person. And sometimes you are, like, not recognizable in a sense. And that is, I don't know if that's necessarily, like, what Bill Gunn was, like, trying to do. But that is, like, what I took away from it, especially, like, after that scene, like, George Mata goes and, like, kills Bill Gunn and he is, or not Bill Gunn, he goes and kills Dr. Hess. And he kills him with the dagger, and then he rises again because he's a vampire now, and he kills him back, and he now has to find a way to live. And with, like, each part, they say, like, the first part, I can't remember the first part.
Part one is he's the victim.
Yes, and then part two is letting go. And he's, like, he has to kind of let go of that trauma that has caused him to now completely change, and now he has to find a new way to survive and cope with that. And, you know, if you're not doing that correctly, if you're not coping correctly, you can bring other people down with you. And I think that's also something that I really admire about Ganja, is that she was not willing to be taken down with Hess. She was all about self-preservation from the beginning. And that is really, like, an important aspect, especially when you, like, lose someone really close in your life. You have to make sure that you keep going. So when, like, leaving the movie, I felt a little better about my own grief that I'm going through, because I was like, you know, I do just have to do what is right for me. And sometimes that is sometimes that's like easier said than done. Also watching movies like this really help with reflecting and, like, trying to understand that, because it feels like even at some parts I don't understand where it is, but this movie, you know, gives you a different perspective on doing that. So
yeah, I'm sorry about your friend. My condolences on that. And it's unique how, like, whenever you visit a piece of media, depending on where you are, you get different interpretations from it. Mm-hmm. This is kind of probably going to sound a little lighthearted, but, like, every time I listen to Hamilton, I always get something else out of it, you know?
Yeah.
Hamilton is the reason why I continued for college. And it's also what's motivated me to most recently go through some struggles I'm going through at my job. So I do want to talk about the music from this film.
Mm-hmm.
It really stood out to me. I really like the music in this film, and I'm not very good at describing music. It's just, I'm doing my best, but, like, I guess it was like some type of jazz or whatever, but, like, whenever they go for, like, happy moments, I like the music, you know, like when they get married.
Mm-hmm.
I like the music there. And then whenever something unsettling happens, it's the children chanting.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, I know something's about to go down because the children are chanting.
Specifically, the children chanting reminded me of Us, like Jordan Peele's Us. Oh. Because when things would get, like, super serious, it'd be like, oh, dee, oh, it would be like the little choir. and that was something that I was a little iffy on it. Like, I think it unsettled me is what it was.
Mm-hmm.
And that the music in general was, like, really added to the, like, whole, like, ethereal, like, aspect, and, like, that fever dream aspect of the movie, because
for sure.
It was very, like the best way I can, like, describe it right now is, like, synths, you know, how they kind of feel, like, long drawn out and, like, very, like, full body encompassing. Like you can like hear it all. And I felt like with the music, they did a really good job at that. Also with the wedding scene, like the music after that, like it was like a remix of, it wasn't like really a remix of the wedding song, but they like continued it into the scenes following that. And I felt like it was like, it was still like a little creepy. I felt like it was a little, I don't know if it was like the version I was watching, because there was like the Kino Lorber version and then there was like the SD version on Amazon. And I was like, it just sounds like a little off key to me, which just kind of added to the whole like unsettling nature of the movie, which made it a little hard to like follow. But yeah, the music was good. Sound design in general, I enjoyed. Nothing like really stood out to me. And I think especially like with music, it's very like easy to get like thrown off by something. I've been watching a lot of movies for Black Star Fest, and the music has been like one thing that has been really interesting to like see how different filmmakers like handle that, because sometimes it helps and sometimes I'm like, dang, it would have been better if it was just silent.
Yeah, I know the guy who did the music. It was the Reverend, the and I'm pretty sure he's Nina Simone's cousin or brother. I forgot.
Oh, that's cool.
But it was cool to see Nina Simone's album in the movie too. Like it was just there, kind of like a little Easter egg, an Easter egg that was supposed to be an Easter egg. I don't think I like how they're used nowadays. No, they're not Easter eggs nowadays. It's just obvious now.
Yeah.
The Easter egg here was Nina Simone's album. It was there and then it was gone.
I think I didn't even realize that. That's actually really cool, and it makes a lot of sense, especially like for the time in which the movie came out. Nina Simone was really big on like advocating for like black people and black people rights, and that's kind of like how she ended up falling out of fame, because she was singing songs about black plight, and a lot of people didn't like that. But I'm like, that makes so much sense that her music, or not only her music, but like her family's music would be in the movie as well. I think that's really cool, and I just love seeing black people work together to make really cool things. One of the articles I read was actually cool, because it was talking about how a lot of movies made it black by black people at that time were very straightforward, like super literal, because blaxploitation was like a big thing that was going on at that point. And this movie was kind of like the first of its kind to be like, it's a black filmmaker making a movie that is not necessarily like a literal, it's like there's a lot of literal aspects of the movie, but there's so much like other things that are going on, there's a lot of interpretation that can be had. So
What's also interesting to me, I forgot where I read this. It was in one of the sources I read, but basically, Bill Gunn, it was a non-union project, right? It was mostly a black crew, black cast, and then, like the day they're gonna film, like start filming, this union came over and just like sabotaged them, like, hey, it has to be a union movie, and then he had to explain to them, like, listen, this is an all black movie, it's all black cast, all black crew. And once they heard that, they left. And he said, that's probably the only time where racism has actually helped me.
That's, and sometimes that is what it is. They'll be like, oh, you're obviously not serious enough about it, just by the color of your skin. And that is, in this instance, I think it like worked to the movie's favor, because they still got to do it. And now 50 years later, I don't think it's too late that people are like taking more recognition to it and seeing like, oh, this was actually a really good movie for its time, probably ahead of its time, because there was even a lot of aspects in this film where I was watching it and I was like, I just feel like I'm seeing so many different other films that have come out in recent years that do similar aspects, of making it a little more ethereal, making it a little more abstract, but still having like a very cohesive plot to it. I'm like, dang, has everyone seen this movie, or they're just ignoring it? I don't know.
Is there anything else you want to talk about the film before I go on to like discussing how it was made?
I feel like I had like one more thought.
Oh, I actually have two thoughts.
Yeah.
When I was watching the movie, in the beginning, when the Reverend is narrating his work and how he works for Dr. Hess as his chauffeur, he says, my boss, he's addicted to blood. And then they go to like a ambulance, like there's like a scene and there's an ambulance there and someone's bleeding and he's just like watching them. I wasn't sure if it was like before or after he became the vampire. It wasn't really clear to me what that was, but it kind of reminded me of iZombie a little bit. Are you familiar with iZombie?
Is that the like CW show with the girl that was like, yeah, she realizes that she's like a zombie or something?
Yeah, so for those of you who aren't familiar, iZombie is a CW show based off a comic book where in the show, the main character, she's scratched by a zombie at a boat party and then she becomes a zombie, but not in the traditional sense of like a George Romero zombie. She's still functioning. She's still like a functioning quote unquote human. She just needs to eat brains like at least once a week to maintain her sanity. And if she doesn't eat brains, she turns into like a George Romero zombie. And with the brains that she eats, she's able to take on the personalities of the person. And also she'll get flashbacks, like visions of their life. And she uses the visions to solve their crimes, like how they were murdered, because she works as a medical examiner. And so, I was watching this. Go ahead.
So she's just like nibbling brains, like while at work, like I'm just gonna have a little snack.
Yeah, it's like full on. She'll eat the whole brain, like once a week. Oh my gosh. Yeah. And there are other zombies in the movie. It becomes a problem, you know? And she can't like eat like animal brains. It has to be human brains, yeah. which is the whole problem, you know? So just seeing Hess like at the crime scene first, not the crime scene, but the scene of the accident. And then later on when he steals blood from the blood bank in a very unique way, he creates the distraction first.
Yeah.
He steals the blood and then goes on. It just reminded me of how like she had to get the job as a medical examiner because she couldn't work as a doctor anymore. Because otherwise she'd eat the victims, you know?
Yeah.
She'd eat the living people.
It's almost like smart. Like I don't know what at that point in the movie if he was like a vampire or not.
Yeah.
Because it's also like he was an anthropologist that was studying like people that drank blood.
Right.
So like his chauffeur maybe didn't know, couldn't just know what he was like doing and just knew like, ah, yeah, he's really interested in blood. Like that's like his thing. But it also could have just been a little like jump forward where he's like, yeah, I'm just driving him around and he is already a vampire. But I don't know. I'm just a chauffeur. It's none of my business. I just drive him places to the blood bank where he comes out with a bunch of blood bags.
But with iZombie, like I still want to go on to, because I love that show, except for the last season. I don't acknowledge the last season.
Okay. So it's not over yet. Yeah.
It is over. It's just, and for me, it ended on a cliffhanger for me.
Okay. Yeah.
So eventually there are more zombies around and they need to eat more brains, but like it's hard for brains to come by without actually murdering them. And so someone sets up like a business where he murders youth, like homeless youth, and then gives them to like rich people to eat, you know, because like he purposely infects rich people so that they give him a ton of money to keep making sure they don't go into a full-on zombie. And then he murders homeless youth because no one will miss him. And then
sounds like ganja, to be honest.
Exactly.
Something ganja would do.
Exactly. And that's what this whole thing reminded me, like how there's a whole class critique here where Hess does that as well.
Yeah.
He did that with the
sex worker.
With the sex worker. Two of them, actually, yeah. And then the other pimp as well. And the one that struck out to me the most because she didn't see it coming. And also because, like, she didn't attack him. Like, the first sex worker and the pimp, they literally stab him first. You know, they jump him. But the second one, she's with her baby, yeah. Right? And then he leaves her there on her bed, just bloodied, with the baby crying. And the camera tilting from left to right.
Yeah.
And that stood out to me the most, you know, like just seeing, like I told you, I'm very much for the working man, very much for the working class. And I hate it when they're exploited by the people in power. And for him, he's kind of the victim, but he's also in a position of power. He got more stronger with this vampirism and used it against her, you know?
So. Yeah, and he's like he's a doctor in this like huge house. I think
that's
something we didn't really even touch base on, like this house that they're in is like a mansion that has its own grounds and a pool and
right.
like fields around it, which I'm like, from an indie DIY perspective, it's so smart to just have it all in the same place. But even with that, they still had like so many other scenes in other very like centralized locations, like very like simple locations, like one scene, one shot here, a shot there. And that's something that I was really excited about. And I remember, this is my last little thought, is that Spike Lee did a like a
A
remake of this
remake.
movie called The Blood of Jesus. And I haven't watched it yet. I don't know if I will. I was like looking at the trailer, and I honestly, like looking at it, I just wasn't excited. I like looking at the trailer for Ganja and Hess, I was like, this seems so like one of its time, but also like so like aesthetically distinct. And not that Spike Lee isn't aesthetically distinct, or not that it's like a bad movie. It's just seeing it be look so polished, and I was very much like, it doesn't really do the same for me anymore. And it's also like a little, it's like a different story, not too much, but still, I was like, it just kind of turned me off to it when I saw it. I'll probably still give it a chance, but and it's cool that Spike Lee, did this, and that also probably helped get the original movie like more recognition and the
Same,
recognition it
yeah.
deserved. Watching the trailer, I was like, dang, this looks so clean. And the budget, I know like the budget for Ganja and Hess was like only like 13,000 or like 350, like
Yeah,
not a lot of
very
money.
small.
Yes, super small. But this like other movie had like a very high budget. It was like in the millions. And I was like, sometimes having more money doesn't make it better. I don't know.
Exactly. That's I think was one of the benefit of having the remake made, because people are like, oh, what was the original one? And then they see it. So, because I saw a screenshot of the movie, the Sweet Blood of Jesus, I think that's what it's called. And it's, like you said, it looks so polished. Like, it's like, I don't want to say it's in 4K, but it's in very high definition. It's out during the day. And I think one of the scenes I like the most with Ganja and Hess is like when it's in the dark, when it's like basically all black, like with Ganja and her monologue, you know, with, and then also the one where her and the lover, you know, like just like the contrast, you know, and then just seeing it all lit up and everything in the remake. I haven't seen the movie yet. I did see the one screenshot and I was like, I don't think that's why people like the first one in reason. Like people are like, this should be an HD. I mean, probably, but like, not too much.
It'd be cool to see a restoration of it. Like, I think if they did one, I definitely would watch it. Another thing that I really admire, gosh, I am a sucker for good typography, like very distinct. The Ganja and Hess like movie logo, honestly, is probably in like my top five like movie logos of all time, because it is this. It's like Hess has the giant cross that is broken, and like all the words just kind of flow together. I'm like being really into like typography and whatnot as of late, and I'm like, movies should go back to making cool logos and crazy posters. And the Sweet Blood of Jesus has a really interesting like packaging, but it like I'm like it does not compare. It does not compare to Ganja and Hess, unfortunately. But yeah, we can go on to talk about how the movie was made. Let's see that.
So I do want to talk a little bit about like Bill Gunn. So I want to mention like I got these sources from both a BBC article called "Ganja and Hess: The 50-Year-Old Vampire Movie Masterpiece Critics Got All Wrong" by Layla Latif. When I went on her website, she said like I love Ganja and Hess, so like I'm glad she wrote about this movie because clearly she did her research and she knows her stuff. So I highly recommend it. It's on the BBC website. And then this article from offscreen.com called "The Uniqueness of Bill Gunn's Ganja and Hess" by Donato Totaro. It was in one, I guess, one of their magazines originally published in October 2021. So that's where I got my sources from. I want to do a better job, keep myself accountable, like where I got my sources from. But basically, Bill Gunn, after like the success of William Crane's 1972 movie Blackula, Gunn was approached by independent production company Kelly Jordan Enterprises to make a black vampire movie. The reason why they approached him because he had recently made a theatrical movie for Warner Brothers called Stap. And unfortunately, it's still unreleased to this day because during that time, it changed hands, changed ownership so many times that they lost the paperwork for the movie. So they couldn't release it because they don't know how it was get paid. Since then, it's only been shown in like museums or like film screenings. It's never been released.
Dang.
But
Now I want to see it.
yeah, I want to see it now. You know, Marlene was in it. You know, that's how she was hired for this movie, because she was in that movie. And so basically, he was one of the first black directors to be to have trust from a major studio. And that's why he was approached by this independent film production company.
And I think that, you know, that's one of the reasons that, like, I was really interested in Ganja and Hess, because I, like, that is what I was, like, reading when I heard it, is, like, this guy kind of, like, changed how black cinema could be viewed. Although it didn't have, like, a huge reception in the United States, yeah. It had a huge reception in France, like, apparently. I also read that off-screen article, and they were saying that there's rumors that, like, a standing ovation started before the movie was even over. and people like Josephine Baker and... more like black, like prominent, like people in France were like, this is a really good movie. Like, this is a movie that kind of depicts black life in a very different way. And when I watched Dry Longzo, that's one of the things I enjoyed about it, is that it depicted black life in a very, like, real way, but also from a perspective of a woman growing up in, like, Oakland, California at that time. Highly recommend that movie as well. I do think you would probably like Dry Longzo more than Ganja and Hess, just because it is a little more, like, straightforward, like, the narrative. And I think the dialogue in that movie is also really good. It's also just a beautiful movie. I bought it, like, on the Criterion Collection from their website, and I lost it.
The sale?
Yes. I don't know where the DVD is, and I'm so sad because it had a poster in it, and I wanted to frame it. I know it's, like, in my room somewhere, but... gosh, I could ramble about that movie for days. But seeing, like, being able to watch a movie from a black director that was, like, big in his time, and being able to enjoy it now, I think is one of the things that I love about digital mediums. You know, there's a lot of fear in us losing the content that we want to see on streaming platforms and whatnot, especially because at any moment they could just pull stuff off. So being able to see something and be like, I'm really glad that I got to watch that before it disappears into the void. I might even buy Ganja and Hess, and I might have to, like, go find a DVD of it somewhere, because I think it's one of those movies that I would probably watch later in life, and probably have, like, even a different take on it. But yeah, it's good. It's a good movie. It's cool.
Yeah. I think there's also, like, a commentary with the DOP on there too. So if you get the Blu-ray, I'm pretty sure. But anyway, so for the screenplay, Gunn wrote the screenplay and made the film in upstate New York, and he recruited his actor friend Dwayne Jones to play the doctor. And Dwayne Jones is famous for being the lead in Night of the Living Dead, and he almost didn't take the role because he didn't want to be typecast, and also because he was a professor at the time. I think he was a French professor at the time, but I'm glad he got into this movie. He played a very critical role in one of the most prominent, if I say the most influential zombie movie of all time that inspired zombies. And then to also be in, like, a vampire movie was pretty cool as well. But I understand why he thought he would be typecast if he was in another horror movie.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I still haven't seen Night of the Living Dead, or at least the original one. Mm-hmm. So I'm definitely going to have to check that out, especially because, dang, this movie looks old.
Just Night of the Living Dead?
Yeah, it's from the 60s.
Yeah, so I saw that movie when I was in high school, like back when, like, Walking Dead just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it still scared me. You know, I'm a scaredy cat, I'm going to be honest. But, like, I'm pretty sure it still holds up. Like Jaws, Jaws still holds up. I think Night of the Living Dead still holds up.
That's good to hear. I love when a movie can hold up to the test of time. I watched, like, the original Godzilla, loved it. I was like, dang, this is amazing. And then I saw Godzilla Minus One, and I was like, this is Godzilla's roots. Like, this is, it was so good. I felt so many emotions watching it. So Ganja and Hess, I think, does stand the test of time. So if anything, it still might even be ahead of its time now, if anything.
Yeah, for sure. So, like, you mentioned how, like, the French audience took it a lot better than the American audience. American audience did not get it. Like, when they went to see the movie, well, Kelly Jordan Enterprises, they commissioned a Hollywood genre film. You know, that's what they're expecting. And that's, unfortunately, that's not what they got.
Yeah.
And when audience went to go see it, that's also not what they got. And so they scrambled to, like, make up some money. So they sold the rights to a grindhouse company, Heritage Pictures, who put out a new version. They edited a new version with footage that wasn't used in the original film, and they just renamed it Blood Couple, and they renamed it so many times as well, just to take some recoup some of the losses. So they labeled it as Black Evil, Black Vampire, Blackout, The Moment of Terror, Double Possession when The Exorcist came out, Vampires of Harlem. And so Bill Gunn was not a fan of the re-edit. Of course he wasn't, because who would not be offended when their own creation is bastardized to
Vampires in Harlem doesn't even sound right.
It doesn't.
It doesn't really take, they're in the city at some points, but they're really not for most of the movie.
It's mostly at the mansion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Bill Gunn, they invited him to go see a screening of this re-edited version. He left after 10 minutes. And he also wasn't a fan of the treatment that this movie got. And so he wrote an open letter to the New York Times titled "To Be a Black Artist." And that's a pretty popular speech. I think I saw it on Letterboxd. "There are times when a white critic must sit down and listen. If he cannot listen and learn, then he must not concern himself with black creativity." Another quote I liked in the same article, in the same letter: "I've always tried to imagine producers waiting anxiously for the black reviewers' opinions of The Sound of Music or Clockwork Orange." I like that because I fucking hated The Clockwork Orange.
I haven't seen A Clockwork Orange. I remember in high school, a lot of people were watching and reading the book, and they were like, "You should read it." But then they would tell me about it and I'd be like, "This sounds terrible. This doesn't sound fun."
They recommended it? Nah.
I was friends with some weirdos. To be honest, they were like, "We love this movie." And I was like, "That sounds crazy. I'm not watching that."
It would make sense if they said Pulp Fiction, because every film cinephile starts out with Pulp Fiction. They're obsessed with it for a little bit. Yeah. I was. Many people are. They eventually get the poster with Uma Thurman, But someone saying "You should watch Clockwork Orange." No, that's a red flag for me.
Yeah, it was very much before. I was into movies in high school, but the people that I was hanging out with weren't. So they were very much just trying to find weird things to obsess over. I think one of them was also had a serial killer Tumblr. I was not a fan of that. I was "You guys are, you're wild." The ones that crush on serial killers, they have a crush on them. It's not fun. But to go back to the statement, to be a black artist, and if you can't handle the heat, then you don't dish it out, Mm-hmm. I think especially as a writer right now, I'm realizing that the stories that I want to tell aren't always going to be relatable to everyone. And yeah, I'm okay with that. And sometimes I work with people that they're we want it to be more relatable. We want it to be a wider audience could like it. And that's just not who I am. And sometimes it's okay if an audience doesn't understand it right away, or if they don't like it. That is maybe kind of the point. I think I'm definitely going to go back and read that article, because it also didn't look too long. So I think I'm probably going to do it after this.
He also has a line in one of his books where he says, "Nothing is more confusing to a white man than a black aristocrat. White folks can understand an educated black man, but they cannot understand a sophisticated black man." And I think that's part of the reason what confused some audiences back then when he went to see Ganja and Hess.
It's how could a black person think of something so thoughtful? Thoughtful and have, I don't know, different, when you leave it, you could have so many different emotions or so many different takeaways from it. Especially since blaxploitation was really big in the 60s and 70s, when you went to go see a movie about a black person, it was going to be straight to the point. It was there was going to be the pinnacle male lead. There was going to be a strong black woman that had superpowers and almost was undefeatable. Bill Gunn just subverted the audience expectations. And I even see that now sometimes with when people go see a movie and they're it wasn't even that good. And it's just because they didn't get it. They don't even want to get it. And it's it's okay to not like something. No one's saying that you can't like something. You just, you need to know what you don't like.
Yeah, and to say it's bad because you didn't like it, no.
It's just, it's not enough. It's not enough for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, good watch. It was, thanks for asking me to do this.
Yeah. One more thing, because I do want to talk about James Hinton, who was the director of photography.
Yeah.
So he was the first black director of photography in North American filmmaking, at least recorded
that
history.
That is cool.
And in the commentary track on both the special edition DVD and Blu-ray, he chose to discuss the scenes of like how he lit the shots for the skins of the black actors. Mm-hmm. And he was intimidated because of his lack of experience, and went against the lighting man's suggestion that they darken Bill Gunn's skin tone and hues to make all the black actors look alike. And he argued not to do that because he didn't want to make them all look alike. He didn't want to homogenize the black skin tone. Because there are black skin, there's brown skin, there's darker brown among all the actors here and among African Americans in general. And he didn't want to erase that diversity. That's also from the off-screen article as well.
The skin color in this movie was beautiful. Mm-hmm. A remaster would only do it justice.
Exactly.
Because, like, yeah, black people, like all people of color, come in so many different shades. So,
yeah.
Like, trying to make them all look the same, honestly, the racist would probably be like, I don't know who was who. Like, that's probably what they would say. So it actually is really, really good that that is something that he was, like, being aware of at that time. Like, I think about Moonlight from time to time, just in how they had such, like, good lighting for black people. And that is one thing I probably wanted to bring up earlier on, is that, like, all the black people in this movie looked really good. Like, they just... Mm-hmm. There was care in the set design and what they were wearing, and there was care in their performances, and there was care in like the cinematography and making sure that they looked right and looked like you could see them. So, and not get washed out.
Yeah, for sure. And that, I forgot, what's the director's name for Moonlight? Because I've discussed Moonlight on this podcast as well.
I'm like, I don't remember. I like don't know any director's names, but
anyway. I remember he discussed Barry Jenkins. Okay.
Yes.
He was inspired by City of God because he saw like how the skin was like, they looked so good on film. And he wondered like, how do they do it? I mean, he learned that like they put cooking oil on them so that they will stand out on the film. I was like, cooking oil on the skin. Wow.
That is crazy. But also that's amazing. Like it's like simple things like that where it's like, dang, if I didn't know that, I probably would have never thought to do that. But now, you know, when I have my own movies, I'm gonna be like, we're not necessarily use cooking oil, but we could
moisturizer.
Like a baby oil might be fine. Like they didn't have baby oil.
I don't know. But yeah, it's just stuff I like. But it's stuff that I never thought about. You know. Like when people started saying like skin on film, I didn't realize that. And so I started seeing some like old TV shows, not even old, like some stuff from like just 20 years ago, like the 2000s, how like when you see like a black person against like next to a white person, it's more focused. Like it's more.
The lighting is set to them. The color, like all the, any backlight, any back coloring is set to them.
Yeah.
And it would make black people look ashy. It would make black people look washed out and not as contrasted. And also even just like coming down to like the hair, like I look back at some old 2000 shows and I'm like, what did they put on your head? Like, why does your hair look like that? And I think there is a lot more care these days in like how black people and people of color in general are like portrayed, which I love, don't get me wrong, but it's also really nice and refreshing to see that there was someone before I was born, before I was even interested in watching movies, that was like, no, we need to make sure that these people look good on camera.
Yeah, and sometimes I can think of two distinct examples. For High School Musical, I forget her name, but the one black actress who was in there, she had to do her own hair because she didn't trust them to do her hair for her. So she'd do her hair before she even showed up to work. And then for Power Rangers, the first, like Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, which is, it's a bad example. It's like an example of like what not to do, how his, it wasn't lined up like his at all. It was like rounded. And I was like, yo, what do they do to you, man?
And it's like simple things like that, that like some people just, you know, especially if you're not thinking about the way different people represent themselves and like to carry themselves, like that's just not something that would come to mind for a lot of people. So we have to have more care for that.
All right. And with that, we are done with our discussion on Ganja and Hess. So, Nikai, was Ganja and Hess a hit or a miss with you?
Oh, definitely a hit. It was a hit. Highly recommend if you have $3. You can watch it on Amazon.
Yeah.
I do think it's worth more than $3. So you should do it.
Yeah, for me, it was a miss, but I do appreciate it. You know, I don't want to say it's a bad movie. Just like I said, it wasn't my cup of tea, but I do appreciate the art and the history behind this movie.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like I want to kind of move away from the hit or miss, but that's kind of the concept of the whole podcast.
It is what it is. I'm like, I admire the fact that you also can be like, yeah, you know, good movie, looked good. Probably not my cup of tea. And I also feel like even just more recently, I am trying to be like more pointed with what I call a good movie. Me and my friends on Letterboxd were like, 4 stars are reserved for 4-star movies. Not every movie is a 4-star movie. You might love it. It might be so much fun, but it doesn't mean it's 4 stars. So trying to be a little more peculiar or a little more particular with that. But I really liked Ganja and Hess, and I think as much as I didn't love it, I think it was a hit, and I do know a lot of people that would really like that movie.
Gotcha. All right. So, Nikai, you got anything you want to promote? Social media projects?
Yeah. So if you're interested in seeing what I do directing and producing. I also do a little bit of photography. So you can follow me at nikai.mp4 on Instagram. And then also I am in the process of starting a production company called Lucky Park Films. So we're going to be a DIY production company based on trying to uplift upcoming creatives and trying to get them get their movies made. So you can follow us at Lucky Park Films at Instagram or on TikTok or YouTube. And right now we're working on a movie that we'll hopefully be shooting in March, which I can tell you more about later.
Awesome. Well, I'm very excited about film projects, so I will be following you there. And thank you again for being here. I really appreciate you. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to our whole conversation today. And until next time, cross off a new film from your list.